Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah reaction to the planned U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement. A couple of would-be candidates can't find their way onto the ballot in the special election to replace Jason Chaffetz, but aren't done trying. An audit finds millions of dollars in errors at the Utah DABC and more. And joining us for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan, and welcome.
Good morning.
Food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson. You probably have a better title than that, but
no, that sounds great.
Thanks for being here. Public lands reporter Brian Maffley, welcome to you as well. Good morning.
Thanks, Roger.
Excuse me. And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
We also want to hear from you during this Friday morning news wrap-up. You can weigh in on the stories that we're covering today and post your questions at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Yesterday, President Trump announced plans to pull out of an accord that nearly every other nation on Earth and certainly every large carbon polluter has signed on to. And this is the Paris Climate Agreement. That agreement was all about reducing greenhouse gas emissions to try to combat climate change. The U.S. withdrawal isn't immediate, but it will have consequences for the agreement. Utah's delegation in Washington, or at least our two senators, applauded this decision, correct?
Yeah, I think if you read Brian and Emma's story today in the Tribune, you'll see that the delegation is, you know, not surprisingly lockstep behind this, as they have been in most issues with this new president. And yeah, there are two other countries that aren't part of this, and it's Syria and Nicaragua that we're joining as out of the accord.
Right, and I think one of them didn't think it was strong enough to join on. So it was
Nicaragua, yeah.
Okay. Well, Brian Maffley, actually, let's bring you into this. Some mixed reaction here in Utah from various quarters, actually.
Yeah.
Positive reaction from, I'm assuming, energy or industry groups, and then disappointed responses from others.
Yeah, well, the responses are really predictable. I mean, the energy industry applauded this decision on the part of President Trump because they felt it's really largely unnecessary, they say. And what I thought, I sat and listened to Trump's speech yesterday, and one of the things that really struck me as interesting is he never challenged the validity of climate science predicting bad consequences. He focused strictly on economic impacts. And when you see the comments or the reactions coming in from our state leaders on one side and the environmental community on the other, they both were framing this question in economic terms, where the environmental community is largely saying, look, we're walking away from some really good opportunities here to be a leader in renewable energy sources. Instead, we're handing that leadership off to other countries, the Chinese in particular, and on our side, on the Utah congressional side, their feeling is it echoes Trump. This was a bad deal for the United States. It's putting a disproportionate share of the emission cuts on the United States, and it needs to be renegotiated.
So kind of competing economic visions here. One of the visions is about massive investment in what you could call new industries, I mean, renewable energy. And then one of those visions is about a massive investment in what you might call old industries, though not really all that old when you get down to it, if you look at extraction of oil and gas and coal. This decision supports one of those two visions, but ignores, again, that underlying problem. He didn't even comment on sort of the science.
Well, he spent a lot of time talking about the coal industry and how the Paris Agreement would shift coal jobs from the United States to other countries. Which seems kind of interesting because, as we know, coal is in decline worldwide, even in China. They've canceled a number of coal-fired power plants that were on the books for alternatives. They're not mining as much coal. And this idea that we're shifting coal jobs isn't really a lot of people aren't really taking that seriously.
Here, just locally in Salt Lake City, Mayor Jackie Biskupski said that the city would adhere to this agreement.
That's right.
And that cities, in a way, are sort of the antidote to Trump's action yesterday.
That's correct. And so are a number of West Coast states. All three, Oregon, Washington, California, I believe, have kind of teamed up to, pledge to back, to follow the climate accord. So we are seeing this kind of resistance at the state and local level in our country.
And is that, I mean, I guess, that, and this is something that actually former President Obama also released in a statement, a kind of rare critical statement of the current president. He said that it's a bad move and that states, cities, and businesses were going to step up here. And I guess the question that I have is that going to happen at the level that it will be enough to, to sort of keep the U.S. under the umbrella of what the Paris Climate Agreement does?
Oh, I don't think so. I think you have to do this as a nation. But I think these are important symbolic gestures on the part of these states and localities.
Okay. Scientists around the world say that, if we don't have concerted action, we're in for hotter atmospheric temperatures, drought, extreme weather, food shortages, rising sea levels, kind of a you name it of things that we don't want to see happen. And maybe we can get some opinions on this story from columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, what do you make of the president's decision, which we should say wasn't entirely unexpected?
Yeah, I think he's kind of made it clear that this is the direction he was going to go from the days of the campaign. You go back to, the promises he made to coal miners on the stump to bring their jobs back. But, if you look at what the Paris Accord is, and Brian can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it's a largely aspirational document. There's not anything mandatory that the United States would have to do. It sets targets and goals and things like that. But there's no penalties, really. There's no teeth involved. But so pulling out of it is largely symbolic in a lot of ways. But it also, the message it sends around the world is that the United States doesn't really care about what the other countries are doing. We're sort of on our own. Maybe it's the America First mentality that the president talked about during his inaugural address. But it also, but it's an abdication of any kind of leadership role in trying to get our hands around this massive problem that we're staring at now. And, there's debate, I guess, about the urgency that we need to do this with. But the predominant sentiment among climate scientists is that this is a real danger that we're reaching sort of a pivot point. There were stories in the last several weeks about the shrinking of the ice shelf and if you talk about Glacier National Park, it's almost just national park now. They're losing their glaciers so quickly. So this entire thing is just it's unfortunate, I think. And if anybody thinks that this is going to do anything to bring Utah or any place's coal industry back, they're fooling themselves, because particularly in Utah, I believe Rocky Mountain Power said they've already made commitments for renewable energy. They're not going to go back to coal. California, as Brian mentioned, and other states that have, they're not going to import electricity that's generated by coal. So there's just no market for it. And if you look at the decline of the coal industry leading up to this, it has nothing to do with the Paris Climate Accord, because that was, as you mentioned, 2016. The coal industry was already in a death spiral by then. The demise of the coal industry has to do with economics and places moving away from these sorts of fossil-based fuels, and it's not going to do, pulling out of a treaty with other countries isn't going to do anything to bring those jobs back.
Well, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Mike Gorell wrote a story that appeared this morning just about that point, that there was a study done, I think it was by the Utah Foundation, I can't remember
who
it was.
Yeah, Utah Foundation.
Saying that essentially coal communities, one way or another, need to look at finding another economic activity to get involved in. Brian Maffley, you cover this. The state of Utah, though, does still see a future in coal, and the president has talked about reviving coal. Would enough spending, bring it back?
Well, Donald Trump talked about developing something called clean coal technologies, which that entails being able to separate the carbon dioxide from the exhaust from power plants and sticking it underground forever. It's a very unproven technology. In fact, some of that research had been done in Utah, and the idea is, hey, we can make coal a non-carbon polluting technology if we just invest in it enough. And he would like to see that happen, and that would make coal an attractive feedstock again. But that's a lot of people think, God, that's, you know, so far-fetched and unlikely, and we should just move on. Mm-hmm. And so, but for Utah, one of the plants that Robert didn't mention was the Intermountain Power Plant, which exports most of its power to California. And because of California's own kind of leadership in this issue, that power plant is abandoning coal under a certain time frame. And Emma Penrod had a story in the paper about that last week.
All right. Check it out at sltrib.com. You know, yeah. I want to just remind our listeners that that they can join this conversation as well by calling us at 801-355-8255 or commenting either at sltrib.com or KCPW's Facebook page. And Brian, there's other stories that you covered this week that I kind of want to pivot towards. And, you know, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke actually reacted to the president's decision. His reaction was positive. But I want to move away from the news about the Paris Agreement and segue to the review that Interior Secretary Zinke is conducting of national monuments. One of those monuments had a sort of expedited review. This is the Bears Ears National Monument here in Utah. The public comment period for Bears Ears closed last week. And you wrote about how people who left comments at the website, regulations.gov, responded. That period is closed. What did you find out about how they were responding?
Well, one of the things we found out is a lot of people submitted comments referencing the Bears Ears. The comment portal was for the entire National Monument Review, but there was an early deadline for Bears Ears comments, and by the end of next week, Friday or Saturday, Secretary Zinke is planning to release some recommendations about what to do with the Bears Ears. It's a 1.3 million acre monument. He could either shrink it, leave it the same, or possibly expand it, although that's pretty doubtful. And the comments were overwhelmingly supportive of the monuments in general and the Bears Ears in particular. And one, you know, pro-monument group did an analysis of these comments. They took a sample of 500 and found like 96% of them were pro-monument. And I read dozens of these comments, and it was actually hard to find anti-monument comments regarding the Bears Ears. But those you found highlighted this idea that setting aside the monument was a quote-unquote land grab to benefit the outdoor recreation industry and these corporate environmental groups. And I don't know where those talking points came from, but this monument was proposed by sovereign Native American Indian tribes, and the Interior Department under President Obama responded to that.
You know, a sort of whether or not the you said that a sort of kind of underlying theme of the comments, whether or not they were in favor of keeping Bears Ears, was that one way or another this land ought to be protected.
Yeah, everybody thought this is a really incredible landscape. So I'm kind of wondering, like, why are we fighting over this so much?
Well, different visions, different beliefs about what protection means.
Yes. And who more? I think more importantly is who calls the shots.
You know, maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke back into this. We're going to have to go to a break here kind of soon. But again, on national monuments, kind of as we were on the climate accord, we're seeing a kind of competing worldview. Part of that story is traditional indigenous worldview versus, you know, what the rest of us have, I guess. And then there's also just a different hope for these lands from different camps. Is there maybe a creative solution to what seems like the same old fight?
Probably not. I mean, it just seems like they're so diametrically opposed at this point that there's not going to be satisfaction on either side. I think what you're seeing is the Trump administration is trying to roll back the Obama legacy in as many ways possible, and this is one of them. And I think, you know, I think the comments were interesting and maybe telling about the broader public support for this, but I think at the end of the day they're not going to matter that much because this administration already is intent on at least shrinking the monument. It looks like, you know, based on what we're hearing, that there's maps going back and forth, so they're obviously sort of trying to fine tune where this is going to end up. So it probably won't be eliminated entirely, but you know, from what we were told a couple weeks ago, is that it's right around 100,000 to 150,000 acres. So you're eliminating almost 90% of the monument at that point. And then the question becomes, what protections do you put in behind it, you know, and how are you going to protect the land if you're not going to do it through the monument? There's got to be a mechanism for it somehow, and I don't know what that's going to look like.
Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune government editor, any, you know, down the line reconciliation between the interests that are at sort of, I don't know, loggerheads here?
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is the courts are going to ultimately make the decision here, and I don't think anybody wants the courts to make that decision, but it looks like that's what's going to happen because there's sort of a political failure. You know, politics is the art of compromise, and there just doesn't seem to be any here. You know, it was interesting that Secretary Zinke came to Utah, and his message was, I'm going to listen to you. The previous administration didn't. And then just judged on who he spent time with, I think Brian reported that, you know, there was a total of maybe 2.5 hours that out of his, 2.5 days here that he spent with groups that support the monument. And the rest of the time he was in the company of the governor and his staff and the congressional delegation and county commissioners and American Indians who support doing away with the monument. And so you got to ask, you know, how much can you hear beyond your immediate surroundings if you're saying, I'm coming here to listen to the people?
What about this public comment period, though? What about the fact that so many people wrote in favor of preserving the monument? Will that make a difference in the, you know, decision-making process, Brian?
Well, the Interior is going to want us to think that. I honestly doubt they're going to give much weight to these comments.
I think when as Dan mentioned, this is going to end up in the courts, and when you go to courts, you want to at least present that you went through a process to reach the conclusion that you reached. Whether, you know, and so I think that's what this is. It's checking off the box to say we listen to people and we're going to go ahead and repeal this monument or shrink this monument. And in terms of the reconciliation, I mean, it's, you know, you look at the Grand Staircase, and I don't think there's been much reconciliation over that monument over the last 20 years, you know, that it's been in place. So, I mean, maybe eventually, maybe given enough time, that, you know, some of the ill will in that area fades. But, you know, I think it's gonna be a sore spot for people on both sides of this for a long time to come.
I think one interesting thing about the Grand Staircase, though, is it's now almost 21 years old. And, you know, it was huge controversy when it was created. There was tremendous opposition, and I would say that there was overwhelming opposition in Utah. But public opinion polls show that has changed over a generation.
That's true.
And now a majority in most polls support keeping the Grand Staircase. And that kind of shows you the history of these monuments, that when they're created, the Tetons, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, they're hugely unpopular among the local populace. But over time, that attitude changes. And now, you know, I spend quite a bit of time up in Wyoming, and the Teton National Park and Yellowstone are what drive the economy of that area of Wyoming. And, you know, those are the biggest supporters, are residents of that area.
You know, before I'm going to take one, just we still have to go to a break, but Brian Maffley, you also wrote a story just thinking about the size of monuments and the history of monuments, about the historic size of national monuments. And detractors of modern monuments say that they're larger kind of by magnitudes than previous declarations were. You wrote that that's not necessarily the case.
Well, it is true that monuments in the more modern era are bigger than they were in the past. However, the monument critics are using really misleading numbers. You're seeing it in one of the legislature's resolutions where they say in 1906, the year the Antiquities Act was passed, monuments, the average size of monuments, there was only three, I think, designated that year, were 15,000 acres. And in 2016, when the Bears Ears was designated, the average size monument was 700,000 acres. Now, I don't know where they got that 700,000 acres. My calculation was more like 500,000 acres for that year. But I'm looking, if you look at the entire, all the 30 or some odd monuments that Obama designated, take out the marine monuments, and you get 85,000 acres as the average. you know, 85,000 acres is still a lot bigger than the 15,000 acres, but I'm getting this wrong. Mm. I'm getting my numbers wrong. My point is that the difference in size of monuments is not that far apart. And so Roosevelt himself, the first Roosevelt, he designated a lot of big monuments, starting with the Grand Canyon in 1908. So there's nothing new of this idea that, you know, your entire landscape can be your quote-unquote object of scientific interest. Mm. However, Utah's congressional delegation would like you to believe otherwise.
And one of the points that a professor, a law professor you talked to made that I thought was really interesting in that story was that there, right after 1906, some of those early monuments were really big, and they, you know, so I think up close to 800,000 acres, something like that.
That was Grand Canyon.
And Congress has had an opportunity for over 100 years to weigh in and change this if they thought it was inappropriate. They haven't done it, and the courts had an opportunity to weigh in and change this if they thought it was inappropriate, and they haven't done it. So the Antiquities Act, it seems to be, at least from this law professor's standpoint, on solid legal footing to giving the president the authority to designate these.
Okay, so well, as I said, we do need to head to our first break, you guys, and there's still quite a bit more to come on the show, but Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, Dan Harry, Kathy Stevenson, we will return in a moment. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, public lands reporter Brian Maffley, food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson, and columnist Robert Gerke. We are talking about this past week's local headlines, and you are invited to join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Let's turn now to somebody who we haven't heard from yet, Kathy Stevenson, who writes about food, alcohol, and culture at the Tribune. And Kathy, you have this sort of split personality as a reporter. Sometimes you're writing about menus and cocktails, and other times it's Zion curtains and liquor licenses. This week you wrote a story that kind of falls into the latter category, an audit of the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control. It found some problems at the DABC. What problems are we talking about, Kathy?
It all stems back to a new computer system that was implemented clear back last July. The DABC switched over from an old system to a new system. And at the time, I wrote about restaurants and liquor stores not having adequate stock and the shipments weren't coming in accurately. But this new audit kind of showed that it was also, the DABC was also having trouble reporting and closing out its books, getting accounting done in the new system.
To the tune of millions of dollars,
millions
apparently.
Between July and December, they didn't record approximately $216 million in revenue. Which, if you remember, the DABC, most of their money goes back into the general fund. So when the DABC's not recording revenue, that messes up the state budget.
Right, well, and you know, we always, this might seem like a joke, but we always think of alcohol sales as funding schools and school programs. Right? Was there any, you know, were there fewer textbooks or kids in school
no,
as a result?
No, because they were ultimately reporting, you know, you're supposed to close your books every 30 days, right? That's a common business practice. The DABC was not able to do that every 30 days. So they were just behind. And to their credit, they knew something was wrong and they did call in the state auditor.
Okay.
And said, you need to come look at this because we're kind of messed up. You know, to their credit, they did know that this was probably going to be a problem.
Is there any, you know, is any of the money unaccounted for?
It's all accounted for. Nothing's been taken. But it does, I think, show weaknesses in the DABC. You know, they went to a new system and kind of dropped the old system, which the auditor said, nobody ever does that. You always keep the old system as a backup to help you. And they were saying the old system was ready to die and we needed to move to the new system because if something happened on the old system, we couldn't fix it. There was no help. So by moving to the new system, they got help from the state IT department. They said the decision to move to the new system wasn't, you know, made in a vacuum. They had all these people helping them. But, you know, there were just many, many bugs to the system.
Well, and you mentioned that when the system was brought online, it caused other problems, including ordering problems for retailers, people who were buying alcohol that they couldn't get, or for consumers as
well. Yeah, if you have been in a liquor store, you know your favorite, you know, booze isn't on the shelf, and you ask them, when is it coming in? And they're like, we're not sure. So I think it's kind of worked out now, but in the first 6 or 7 months, you know, between July and even into January of this year, there were still problems with the system. Restaurants weren't getting their orders. They were having to run around to different liquor stores to try and find them, which when you're a monopoly, you know, you can, it's not like you can just, you know, if you can't find it at Walmart, you go over to, you know. Right. Well, when you're the monopoly, you're the only place we can get it. So that is the problem that people see.
And is that's exposing that particular flaw when there are problems. I want to bring in Robert Gerke from the Opinion Desk. The DABC here in Utah doesn't have, I don't know, the most spectacular reputation. This can't exactly help.
You know, they, God bless them, they try. They run on this shoestring budget that the legislature lets them keep because they generate all of these sales and then the legislature takes most of it away and puts it in other programs, in school lunch or other programs. And so they're left with this sort of this meager subsistence to try to run a business, basically a fairly large business, and it's an almost an impossible task that they're facing. Now they have run into some of the problems have been of their own causing, and some of the problems are you know become apparent when, as Kathy mentions, you can't get the products you want. They're having high turnover with their staff because they're paid such poor wages and no benefits and things like that. It's a lousy way to run a business, frankly. And so the legislature should at some point recognize this and step in and say, hey, if we're going to be the sole operator of this major operation around the state, then maybe we need to do it right and not try to bleed them dry.
Have there been reforms attempted in the past?
Oh, there's all kinds of reforms attempted. You know, and it's funny because the legislature always talks about how government should be run like a business. But the one business they do run, they don't run like a business.
Kathy, have these problems been resolved, fixed?
I think they're still kind of working them out. The audit pointed them out. The DABC, had a little bit of an issue with some of them because they felt like they were a little bit strong. The audit was a little bit strong, and things weren't as bad as they made it sound. But I think one thing that pointed out in the audit, the DABC financial director, in the last 4 years, they've had three different ones. They cannot keep a staff because accountants and people with financial expertise can find a better job, with higher paying job outside of government. And so that department has struggled. So
have there been, I'm sorry, I'm just thinking about this. There have been in the past legislative initiatives to try and take alcohol in the state of Utah entirely private, right?
There was some discussion rumors a few years ago about a couple members in the House that were going to try to initiate that push. It's never gotten very far. The idea was kind of floated, but it didn't get a lot of legs. And frankly, it's just going to be difficult to do because the Mormon Church is probably not going to be too keen on the idea. Now, the idea that they proposed that I think, frankly, is pretty interesting is that the state would still control where and when and what is sold and how much it's sold for. They'd be sort of the wholesaler, and then the retail outlets would be run by private organizations. And so the state then would still have control, still get revenue from these, but would not be in charge of the day-to-day operations of these various establishments. But that's if that does happen, I think that's a long ways off, just because there's so much. The system right now is entrenched, and there's going to be resistance from the church.
Okay, that's Robert Gerke. A quick reminder to our listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories that we're covering. Again, 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Kathy, maybe we'll come back to you later in the show for some of the other half of your expertise, which is just to ask you about some new bar and restaurant recommendations. But for now, let's move away from the world of food and beverage to look at some news related to law and order and go back to government editor Dan Harry. I'm talking about the news that Salt Lake County Sheriff Jim Winder is done with Northern Utah and is headed instead to Red Rock Country. And he's got his reasons for doing this as well. Tell us about this, Dan.
Well, he's cited a number of reasons. It looks like really the timing of this is happening when there is a very big disagreement between the sheriff and Salt Lake City, its mayor and its police chief, about how to handle the jail, about the crime that's occurring, particularly in the Rio Grande District down by the Tribune, where we all spend much of our time.
We're not responsible for that.
Well, not all
our
of it.
Our share, maybe.
Anyway, the sheriff has really angered a lot of law enforcement agencies by putting restrictions on who will be booked into the jail, because he says, you know, we don't have the room to incarcerate folks who aren't committing violent or serious crimes. And so police officers, not only in Salt Lake but in other agencies as well, are getting very frustrated that they feel like they can't really enforce the law, because if you can't lock somebody up, you know, what's to stop them from just turning around and committing another crime? And so he's had this frustration. It's gotten to the point where we just found out the other day that the mayor, who used to be the sheriff's top assistant, and the Salt Lake City police chief are not talking to the sheriff.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Not talking to the sheriff, and haven't done so for some time. We're not sure if it's been weeks or months, but it's been a long time since they've actually had a conversation with one another. And that's not a good situation when you kind of have to work hand in glove, because, you know, you've got these police forces that all depend on the county jail. The county runs the jail for all of the cities.
Well, it sounds like some obviously strained relationships. You mentioned this a little bit too, but back in March it was that Winder had some kind of unusual suggestions for how to deal with homelessness in your
yeah, he had this like 21-point plan, which seemed to critics very draconian. It talked about, you know, immediately emptying the shelter downtown and setting up a camp for homeless people that would have a secure perimeter, and people would be allowed inside, would be inspected, you know, that they couldn't bring contraband or booze. They couldn't own bikes that were unlicensed. They would confiscate bikes that weren't properly licensed. It was a dramatic change from the way that we deal with homelessness now. And, it was kind of a way of saying, we're not doing enough. We need to do something, and it needs to be dramatic. And it seemed to come out of nowhere, because we're in this sort of longer term process of trying to figure out how to deal with the homeless situation. And but Winder now has kind of said he did that out of frustration, because he felt like, again, he wasn't being listened to, and the powers that be weren't talking to him.
Okay, so the rift predates those suggestions. Him and people in the city. So off he goes to Moab, you know, a smaller—
Off you go to Moab, yeah. They have some problems there. It's a much smaller place. You know, he's going to be dealing with a very different population. You know, far, far fewer crimes, far less serious crimes there in Moab. But, you know, it's got its own challenges as well. It's kind of a party town. It's a small permanent population, but they get huge influxes during the summer season and at other times of the year.
A desert playground at the same time doesn't sound like too terrible of a move. Robert Gerke, I don't even know what to ask you here other than, do you have any comment on the sheriff's part?
Yeah, I mean, I think this points to a larger problem, and that is that nobody in the city and county can get along with each other. They all act like petulant children, and that's why we're having such a hard time solving any of the problems we've got. Between the sheriff not talking to the mayor and the police chief and McAdams not talking to Poskupski, and it's just, you know, nobody can get along, and that's why, you know, when we're talking about the homeless situation in particular, it's so difficult to solve this because we can't behave like adults.
Well, the time has come for another quick break here on Behind the Headlines, but do stay tuned. We've still got a story about NSA surveillance during the 2002 Winter Olympics and the plight of a couple of would-be candidates in the special election for Utah's 3rd Congressional District. That's coming up on Behind the Headlines after the break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Brian Maffley, Kathy Stevenson, and Robert Gerke. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling us at 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. And we are now kind of in the final stretch of the show here and with not a lot of time left, but I do want to turn to a story that just came out yesterday, and it's the latest development in a lawsuit. The suit contends that the National Security Agency conducted blanket surveillance of Salt Lakers during the 2002 Winter Olympics. Dan Harry, the latest is that a former senior official with the NSA is providing some additional fodder to the story through a statement that he made. This is a guy by the name of Thomas Drake. What did he say?
Yeah, he's a NSA whistleblower who at one point, after coming out as a whistleblower, was charged with espionage, but those charges were eventually dropped. But he has supported this lawsuit brought by former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who's a civil rights attorney. And he said that, he discounted the statements of Michael Hayden, the former NSA director, said that this blanket surveillance did occur, that it was in violation of federal law, that all communications were intercepted and maintained during that period of time, contrary to the testimony that officials have given. So, this is something that they've filed with the lawsuit to back up their claims, and we'll see where this goes. The government tried to get this lawsuit dismissed in January, and Judge Shelby would not allow that, said the lawsuit would continue, so we'll see where it goes.
Warrantless wiretapping is not an unfamiliar term. This is part of what's in this. To anyone who follows U.S. domestic surveillance practices, and especially during the war on terror, and we learned from leaks. There was the famous leak from Edward Snowden that the NSA works to collect massive amounts of data. But 2002 was kind of a different time, and I'm imagining that we're mostly talking about phone calls to landlines. Is that an accurate assessment?
Cell phones as well. Okay. I think internet communications, sure, and emails, absolutely. Remember that was just months after the terrorist attack. The Olympics held in Salt Lake City were really the biggest national an international event held after the terrorist attack. So security was foremost on everyone's mind. And who knows what our security agencies, what lengths they went to at the time.
Dan, I don't know if you're the person to answer this question, but how did this lawsuit come to be? It has to do with a former Salt Lake City Mayor, Rocky Anderson, who's also an attorney.
Yeah, he's an attorney. He's got plaintiffs, which include a kind of a motley crew. Senator Howard Stevenson, right, a very conservative Republican from Draper. Dita Seed, a very liberal former city councilwoman. It's folks who feel like the government oversteps when it comes to national security and violating people's civil rights.
Robert Gerke, I don't know what we're going to get from this lawsuit, but we do have a constitutional right to privacy. Is that something that our government is aware of?
Well, I think he kind of hit on it when we noted that the time that this occurred after 2001 was a time when these limits on privacy and government surveillance were pretty fuzzy, and they were pushing the boundaries. And it's not terribly surprising if they did gather this vast amount of data that they did. I mean, but I think it also is interesting about what it might say, about where we are today. I mean, we've got the big NSA facility here in Utah now, the storage facility, data center, and we're What does this say about where we are today? And are we now, you mentioned Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks, and there have been a lot of revelations beyond the Olympic surveillance about what the government does to monitor our communications, and it's unsettling. And I think it's encouraging, at least, that Rocky Anderson is pursuing this to try to get some answers and some vindication.
Well, we'll see where it goes, and check out Christopher Smart's article on this if you haven't already, revealing stuff at sltrib.com. Before we run out of time, one more story from this past week's news that this is the one that has to do with candidates trying to get on the ballot in the special election to replace Jason Chaffetz, who is stepping down at the end of this month. Dan Harry, Chachi Teng, a BYU professor who previously ran against Chaffetz, has hit a snag in becoming a candidate. What happened with his
An interesting one. Chachi Teng wanted to file as a Republican candidate in the 3rd Congressional District. He was in a primary last year with Chaffetz. And he is a BYU professor who was in China, still is in China, with about 20 students, I believe, and teaching abroad there. And he tried to file as a candidate on a video chat. His son brought the laptop into the elections office and, you know, was there to testify and get all the papers signed and declare himself as a candidate, and they wouldn't allow it. They said, no, you have to be here in person. They cited state law and said they had no discretion in this matter, that he couldn't register as a Republican candidate unless he was there in person.
And he was actually, I mean, waving at elections officials.
He was waving, there to answer questions and everything else. And they said, no, the law requires that you're there so we can verify you are who you say you are. And
are there exceptions to this rule?
Well,
there are if you're in military or I believe if you're working for the government.
Working for the government overseas.
Yeah, but he didn't fit either of those two exceptions. Yeah. And so they.
So I guess if BYU was a public school, then he could have done that. And the other case was Jim Bennett, the son of the former U.S. Senator Bob Bennett. He is one of the founding members of this new United Utah Party. It's intended to be a centrist party for disaffected Republicans and Democrats. And they got all their paperwork in last week and to certify as a party and win a place on the ballot. And then he wanted to file the next day as that party's candidate. And they wouldn't let him do it. They said, we haven't had time to certify the party as a a ballot guaranteed party, and so you can't file as a candidate for that party. He asked to do it provisionally, saying, you know, I'll file, and then if you find that we had the correct signatures and certify the party, then we could do it. They would not allow that. They said they did not have that discretion in the law. I think the folks at the elections office have a reputation of trying to, you know, like bend over backwards for access and, you know, to let people participate in the electoral system that we have. In this case, it seems like there was a measure of inflexibility that I think is not kind of standard.
Well, but it is a special election. It is kind of an expedited election. Is that part of this, Robert Kirky?
Yes. I mean, I think it is. They are on very tight time frames to try to get these candidates on the ballot or get them registered. If they're gathering signatures, they're on a tight time frame to validate and certify those signatures. But it's also a little strange to me that we've got this special election that's kind of, they're making it up as they go along, basically, because they don't have any real clear guidelines. And then when it comes to which candidates are and aren't allowed on, they're very rigid on those. You know, they're playing loosey goosey with the other rules, but these candidate qualifications, they're being pretty inflexible.
That really is the striking thing about this. The as Robert said, they're making up the rules as they go. All state law says is the governor can proclaim an election, and he's absolutely making these rules up and these time frames as he goes. And then to say, sorry, we have no flexibility, this is how it's going to work, it just doesn't sit well.
Chachi Teng is suing. He's saying, I disagree with your decision. Jim Bennett, we don't know exactly
Jim
what
he's Bennett doing. Has an attorney, and he said he's weighing that, so we'll see if he files suit as well.
The Tribune article on this pointed out that I don't know if this applies to Chachi Teng, but for Jim Bennett, he still has time to file as
unaffiliated. Either one of them could do that. It's quite a disadvantage, you know, when you don't have the party label next to your name. So that's why they're resisting that.
At the same time, there is within the Republican Party, or there has been within the Republican Party, some infighting over election law changes that occurred a couple of years back. But the new head of the GOP in Utah says that he wants to do away with the civil war that is racking the GOP in Utah. And is that doable, I guess?
Robert, you?
Well, I mean, there are some talks about ways that they can come to an agreement that might nullify or at least end the lawsuit that the Republican Party's been fighting, because the lawsuit is really has been hurting the party for a number of years. The big donors who've typically financially supported the party have walked away. As this lawsuit's gone on, they've got over $300,000 in legal fees that they've racked up and they aren't able to pay. They've got $150,000 roughly in debt that they're unable to pay from, you know, because they can't raise money. Apparently, from their most recent convention, bounced $30,000 worth of checks to vendors who provided services for that. The chairman is imposing a registration fee for their upcoming special election of $20 per delegate or per person.
That's been dialed back, though, right?
He's now calling it a highly recommended contribution or donation. But, you know, so the party is in some dire financial straits, and that was one of the reasons James Evans lost his reelection bid. And now the new chairman has a fairly heavy lift to try to get it financially solvent, and you can't really do that as long as this lawsuit's going. That what I've heard that they're talking about is raising the threshold to 70%. So if you go to convention, you have to get 70%, or else you have a primary, which would mean there would be more Republican more primaries for both parties. The thinking is that the signature route would go away. And the 70% threshold then would be the bar you'd have to clear to get to avoid a primary. So the thinking is you'd have more primaries, and that would encourage people to participate, and then you don't necessarily need the signature path. That
requires a law change, though.
That would require a change to the law. It would also probably require some buy-in from the Count My Vote group, I don't think are going to be too keen on that idea, because they did, though. I mean, before the law was changed, when they were still gathering signatures, they did propose that. They said if we raise the threshold to 70%, if the parties raise the threshold to 70%, we'll go away. We're fine with that. So it kind of remains to be seen whether or not that they'll take them up on that, if that is the offer on the table, and whether they'll go along.
Yeah. Pending potential changes there. And in the meantime, we're waiting for this election to take place. Chaffetz stepped down on June 30th. Mm-hmm. The election takes place on November 7th?
Yes, but the primary is on August 15th.
Okay. And in the meantime, Chaffetz's office will just carry on without him, is the idea, right?
I mean, imagine that. I mean, yeah, it's tough to imagine.
You do have the situation where, I mean, because Congress works so hard all the time, they take an August recess. They're gone for a good chunk of July because of the 4th, and so really, there's only 40 days of work that is going to be missed. Actually, 50 days of work that is going to be missed from June 30th to the
election
time when the new candidate is sworn into office. So you know, it is a long time, but other states are experiencing similar vacancies in Georgia and Kansas and elsewhere.
Right. Well, guys, we'll see what happens there, and who fills this seat. But right now, we've got to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. Our final segment of the show. We're running out of time, and who's ready with an underplayed story? Anyone?
I've got one.
Dan Harris. The
candidate filing for municipal elections, the city elections that are being held this year, and this third district race will piggyback on. The candidate filing period opened yesterday. It lasts 1 week. And there were some interesting developments yesterday. One was Richard Snellgrove, the county councilman, pulled a Chaffetz. He just got elected in November to a new term, and now has decided he doesn't really want to be on the county council. He'd rather be Murray mayor. So he filed for Murray mayor.
Wow.
And, you know, what will happen, unlike the Chaffetz vacancy, is the Republicans will appoint his replacement.
Okay. Anybody else who's got one?
You know, Taylor Anderson had a really nice story over the weekend about this program, this rehabilitation, sort of a drug rehab program, and sort of the uncertainty that it's facing because of
that. That was actually Matt Piper, but
it was a great story. So go check that out. It's about sort of the uncertain future of this program that's helped people turn their lives around and whether they can get the financial support they need to keep it going.
Keep going. All right. Kathy Stevenson, your pick for Underplayed Story.
I'll just say one I liked this morning. You know, we're used to always pointing bad things about government, but the Unified Police Department's new crime lab, and it's supposed to be robotic and kind of get the rape kits tested sooner, which I think really has been a big issue, and I think anything that kind of speed those up is good news.
Yeah.
Okay. And Brian Maffley.
Well, Emma Penrod has been covering the saga of the Diesel brothers. It's a legal battle, and this week she had a story about their response to a lawsuit brought by environmental groups accusing them of illegally modifying people's diesel trucks so they belch out huge clouds of black smoke. It's known as rolling coal. And these guys, you know, with their nicknames are great, Heavy D and Muscle Man, or, you know, anyway, they claim in their filings that, hey, no, we can do this without illegally modifying our customers' trucks. It's all legit. So that's the news here. It's like you can, you know, modify your rig to pollute like that and it'd still be legal. So
I'm looking into getting that on my Prius, actually. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. All right, guys. Well, I'm going to skip my underplayed story. It was a kind of depressing one about a beheaded cougar. Well, you can check it out at srtrip.com.
Yeah, that was number two for me, yeah, Roger.
But Dan Harry, Kathy Stevenson, Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining us today on the show.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen at Utah Public Radio, and to the show's producer, Emily Means. Thanks to you for tuning in. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Again, thank you for tuning in, and have a great weekend.